thank you very much. I think I have to start by the obligatory, obvious thing. Thank you again ever so much to Professor Hopper and Dr. Gulchin, Imre Hopper, for putting on, quite simply, the best conference I've ever been to. As I said in something once, some article somewhere, the only conference worth attending. Now, the Enlightenment. As I'll probably come to in a little bit, there's obviously an interesting question raised already by the fact that we sometimes talk about Enlightenment and sometimes about the Enlightenment. But before I go any further, again, obligatory disclaimer. Am I opposed to everything about the Enlightenment completely? No. Am I some kind of dyed-in-the-wool reactionary? The jury's out on that one. Enlightenment and the Enlightenment. Well, first of all, the term did not originate in English, didn't originate in England. There are two foreign terms, foreign to me, which came first. The first was the French Lumière, and a little later, but not too much later, the German Aufklärung. Apologies to people who speak those languages. The understanding was always that Enlightenment, because here we're speaking without the definitive the, was a process. Aufklärung in particular, I think, with a very interesting series of essays during the reign of Frederick II with the title Was ist Aufklärung? And they generally did make the point. Moses Mendelssohn, even Kant made the point that Enlightenment was a process. And this is already much less ambitious, grandiose, over the top than the kind of Enlightenment mythology and ideology that we see today of Enlightenment as the be all and end all and as a much more tangible thing. It must be said that Enlightenment, when it becomes the Enlightenment, was and remains a construction, an historical construction, that is something made up by historians, sometimes for convenience, sometimes for more ideological purposes. In the 1930s, you start to see historians like the Italian Venturi talking about the Enlightenment. It's very obvious, I think, why historians would start to do this sort of thing in the 1930s with fascism everywhere. They saw fascism, they thought, well, we don't like this. What do we like? And everyone, in some sense, is some kind of reactionary, and so even the left, when they're looking for something as an alternative, they go into the past. They look for something that happened in the past, some golden age. And so the academics tended to look back. They looked back to the 19th century. They went, we don't like that either. That was full of romanticism and nationalism and so forth. So they looked to the 18th century. This historical construction became the Enlightenment, a kind of canon of Enlightenment thinkers. And it became much more solid in the 1950s, after the Second World War, again for obvious reasons. And not too much later, you start to see things like the Enlightenment, the International Enlightenment Congress, in the first one in 1963 in Geneva. So, the Enlightenment as a construction, but Enlightenment as the thing that actually happened in the 18th century. How do they fit together? That's an interesting question, and it's very difficult because the historians have presented the one to the other to us. But indeed, actually, the historians have been so ambitious with the construction of this term that the ambition that moving first from the idea of a quite discreet intellectual elite in France, then moving to the idea that it was something, some part of what John Pocock would call a family of thought, often in France, then Germany, then often all across Europe, then not just the elites, but also people at the bottom. There's historians like to talk about cultures these days, a coffee house culture and all that sort of stuff. And then extending enlightenment all around the world to the talk of a global enlightenment. Well, nowadays, it's coming full circle. And it's talking about the enlightenment in academic history is not going to get you very far. The coherence of the term has been really damaged by the excessive ambition of some ideological historians. But what do we think of when we think of enlightenment or the enlightenment? John Robertson, who's a historian of thought at Cambridge, summarizes the enlightenment in the following way. It, quote, it held out the prospect of a new, explicitly modern understanding of human beings' place in the world and of radical improvement in the human condition, unquote. That's quite a, I would say, a rosy presentation of it, but it does, I think, get to the two central features of it, which is a change in the way people thought and the change in the way people wanted to act. If you like, there was an epistemological element and a more political element. The politics of the Enlightenment are pretty well known, but also pretty difficult to explain because they were so varied. I don't propose to spend much time talking about that. The general tendency was some kind of leftism, some kind of populism sometimes, but sometimes an elitist version of leftism. Indeed, some so-called Enlightenment thinkers definitely buck the trend in this regard. Voltaire was certainly not interested in democracy. Bastiat is sometimes mentioned alongside Enlightenment thinkers, and he certainly bucks the trend. So I don't think it's going to be too productive if I talk about the politics. The thought is much more interesting, and I think it's important to talk about Enlightenment thought or thinking about thinking, because this is something particularly stressed by the Austrian school. If you make some kind of error about free trade, or some kind of error about a particular rule, regulation, or law, you can probably work it out. And if you've got muddled thinking already, it won't stand out too much. What really matters is getting first principles right, deducing from there, and having a right approach to man, society, nature, and so forth through thinking the right way. The Enlightenment did, I think, bring about another nail in the coffin of the old-fashioned, what would be sometimes referred to in the literature as the ancient way of thinking. The predominant approach beforehand could be characterized as scholastic, very generally. But to take, say, the French Enlightenment in particular, they were influenced by the 17th century English thinkers, Locke, Bacon, Newton, and generally French 18th century philosophers were some kind of Lockean empiricist. There was a move away from the construction of grand systems and towards looking at specific phenomena. Why was this? They preferred to go to the phenomena themselves because of this opposition to a use of a mathematical deductive method, which you see in Buffon, Diderot, even quite an extreme form of positivism in D'Alembert. But why was that? Why? Where did this kind of empiricism come from? We understand the scientific method, we understand the 17th century developments here, but I think it does go back much further. I would be inclined to say that Enlightenment thinking, Ed Fazer, who's a very good writer, said recently something along the lines of, the Enlightenment, to the extent that it was original, wasn't very good, and to the extent that it was unoriginal, it could be good. Well, I think this is the case not only in politics, but in terms of, say, metaphysics, ontology, epistemology, and so forth. There was a backstory, though, to the change in thought in the Enlightenment. So one of the French Enlightenment thinkers drew a genealogy of knowledge, where he, in typical Whiggish progressive fashion, dismissed everything and anyone before the 16th century. And he hailed the 17th century sense-based philosophy of Bacon, Newton, and Locke. And then this, in turn, influenced Condillac, Buffon, Montesquieu, Voltaire, and so on. I think, however, this goes back further to Scotus and to William of Ockham. There are two developments in late medieval philosophy which seem to have brought about this shift, this move towards bad, unsystematic ways of thinking. One, which I don't want to dwell on too long because it's unnecessarily specific if I do that, but one is Scotus's idea of the univocity of being. By this, we mean that being is a very simple idea. Scotus moved away here from the old Thomistic and scholastic view that being was, it was more productive to talk about essence, that being was something which was an analogous term in the sense that everything had being, everything participated in being. Now, Scotus moved away from this towards univocity, which is the idea that it's a simple concept, you either exist or you don't. This then in turn, quite ironically, in view of the fact that the two were on different sides of a particular debate, but it in turn did influence William of Ockham. William of Ockham is quite famous for the idea of nominalism. The idea of this approach to thinking being that the existence is an argument against the existence of abstract objects, ideas, concepts. In a sense then, goodness, rightness, beauty, truth, etc. do not truly exist. And to this day it still very clearly influences modern philosophy. Ockham's thoroughgoing attack was on the idea of metaphysics as such. And like later empiricists, the foundation of knowledge was phenomena, our experience of little individual, what we would see as insignificant events, looking at rocks and stones and so forth. Now, Ockham, we know, definitely influenced Locke politically, and I don't think it's at all unreasonable to draw the connection epistemologically and in metaphysics too. But there was still more development to happen. He wasn't a full-blown empiricist like Hume, but nevertheless the origin of the Enlightenment was there. So in a kind of tentative answer to how enlightened was the Enlightenment, well, in the sense that it was part of a broader ongoing trend, it was as enlightened as it could be in this general drift. But it wasn't without earlier germs, so to speak. Now, I mentioned Hume, who is also pretty representative of this distorted Enlightenment approach to thought. He sought to extend philosophy in general, to philosophy in general, the methodological approach of the scientific revolution of Newtonian physics. And as such, being much more radically empiricist than Locke or Berkeley, as such, he was much closer to modern analytic philosophy. Now, all this is, I think, important because, as I said, you have to get thinking about thinking right if you want to go any further. Now, this isn't to say that that Enlightenment thinkers were without any kind of bias themselves, or that they remain without any kind of bias. It's of course their one of their favourite claims that they are cosmopolitan, they are tolerant, they are unbiased, they are indifferent. But it's very rarely the case because they tend to have a pretty narrow, limited view of reason itself. And F.C. Copleston, who's was a very good Jesuit historian of thought, I think beautifully summarizes this existence of their own prejudices and presuppositions. Quote, as we saw, they assumed a theory of progress according to which progress consists in the advancing rationalization of man, this rationalization involving man's emancipation from religious superstition and from irrational forms of government. In their opinion, the fruits of progress were best represented by themselves, the enlightened free thinkers of the Parisian salon, and further progress would consist in the spread of the ideas for which they stood and in the refashioning of society according to the ideals of the Enlightenment. Once a reform of the social structure had taken place, men would advance in morality and virtue, for the moral state of man is largely dependent on his environment and on education. And he goes on to almost characterize the general tendency to presupposition among them as a kind of new dogma. They came to the study of human history, quote, with a presupposition which exercised an undue influence on their interpretation of history. For example, they were unable to appreciate the contribution of the Middle Ages to European culture. The Middle Ages inevitably appeared to them as the Dark Ages, for if progress meant advance towards the fulfillment from the leading features of medieval culture, etc., etc. I do recommend Copleston on the French Enlightenment in particular. Now, the legacy of the Enlightenment is still clearly with us. If you look at any, certainly any British university's philosophy faculty, it will all be analytic philosophy. You'll see Quine, Goodman, and so on and so on. And again, an almost dogmatic opposition to anything which might strike them as scholastic. And I think they have well and truly now achieved what the earlier Enlightenment thinkers wanted to at the outset, Bernard de Fontenelle, who was secretary to the Academic, to the Academy of Sciences in Paris in the 18th century, described Lumière as, quote, a spirit of philosophy almost entirely new, unquote. Well, this has become embedded in modern philosophy, this entirely new and, in my view, entirely empty approach. The two forceful concepts, as I said, being nominalism, which replaced idealism, and giving us a kind of empiricism, and an inductive reasoning, a move away from the deductive approach, which characterizes, say, the work of Rothbard and Professor Hopper, giving us the scientific method and scientism which dominates the 21st century experience, and together they quite easily often make for a kind of materialistic or pluralistic relativism, some kind of postmodernism. And I know Professor Hopper is going to talk a bit later in the conference about Steven Pinker. But he seems to me to represent almost a caricature of the Enlightenment itself. Of course, updated to present times. But we can see the kind of scientism in Pinker that many counter-Enlightenment philosophers sometimes quite harshly accused some thinkers of, the attempt to create a new science of man, the attempt to apply the scientific method to absolutely every area of human life, a strong belief in progress, and treating morality and much of philosophy and psychology as if it were physics. I came across, actually, a very good review article of Fraser's book not long ago, which is incredibly bitchy and gloriously so. Fraser points out that the metaphysical emptiness of Pinker's general approach, particularly in Enlightenment Now, where again he seems to have become more of a parody of himself than ever before, focusing on what the scholastics, particularly St. Thomas, or most famously St. Thomas, focusing on what we would see as insignificant, efficient causes, looking at the mechanics of things and the mechanics of life, rather than the formal and the final causes, the purpose of things. And as a result, you get an excessively mechanistic worldview, as opposed to the deeper, richer, medieval scholastic understanding of a thing's purpose and essence, and including, of course, applying this to man. This is how the two things join up. If you don't think properly about the purpose of thought itself, you're not going to think properly about the purpose of anything else. And because Pinker, says Fraser, looks only at efficient causes, everything is just a blob of particles and has no ultimate purpose, including knowledge itself. Knowledge becomes, on this understanding, simply about power. If you don't set out, when you're investigating the world, to understand something's purpose or essence, you're not coming to understanding or to wisdom. You're simply, in your motivation and in your conclusions, seeking and achieving power, the power to manipulate and control objects and often people for your own personal pleasure. Pinker in Enlightenment Now, which if any of you are insomniacs, I would recommend, but also if you ever need a laugh, abandons what he calls the illusion that anything has a nature. But if you think about the implication of this, and it bears out quite well in the rest of Pinker's work, if you think about the implication of this for thought itself, then it completely undermines rationality. If everything, including reason, doesn't have a nature and therefore a purpose, then what is rationality? As Fraser says, quote, only if reason has as its purpose the pursuit of truth that we can say, it is only if reason has as its purpose the pursuit of truth that we can say that there is an objective difference between good reasoning and bad reasoning, unquote. If there is no purpose to reasoning, the purpose of which presumably is truth, then good reasoning won't mean anything. It won't be to get you to anywhere in particular. Pinker is, again, as I said, worth reading for a laugh. However, I'll start drawing to a conclusion with, again, more qualifications and disclaimers. It is not the case, as historians now are finally coming to the realization, that there was any one Enlightenment. And some of them are better than others. The English influenced the French, and the French, I would say, sometimes misrepresented and misapplied the early English Enlightenment. But the German, for instance, was pretty good. It was certainly much more nuanced. The early Enlightenment thinkers in Germany were not motivated principally by relativism, by empiricism or positivism. One of the first, the first who you would explicitly, when talking about this German Enlightenment, mention would be Thomasius, who was a Lutheran pietist. There was no explicit goal to undermine the very foundations of rationality itself, even if sometimes that was the general tendency. Pietism tended to divorce philosophy and theology from rationality, not because he wanted to, but because he was simply more interested in being pious. He wasn't very interested in thinking, but it wasn't because he was actively interested in not thinking. Christian Wolff is, I think, much better. You certainly couldn't accuse him of this sort of French empiricism, this French exaggerated empiricism. In a sense, Wolff was hardly enlightened at all. And so I would say that we can have a much more nuanced line generally when it comes to French, as it would, when it comes to German rather than French Enlightenment, and also politically. German Enlightenment thinkers were less inclined to be rabid, rampant leftists, and also more inclined to occasionally flirt with rationalism. And I'll end almost where I started with one more comment about politics and the Enlightenment being a slightly nuanced area. I haven't treated it in any depth because it's far too varied to try to distill into a few minutes. And it's, as I said, essentially a later stage problem. It's something much further down the intellectual structure of production. And indeed, when you look for the origins of what we would call modern political ideas, the idea of the state, the idea of the sovereign state, you don't see this occurring for the first time or reoccurring for the first time in Europe around the time of the Enlightenment. Certainly, one of the more fruitful areas to look, I would say, in this area is the late medieval thinker Marsilius of Padua, who in some sense was influenced by Dante, but certainly believed in a sovereign kingdom based on sovereign nations, which was completely alien to the received wisdom of the Middle Ages. So you can't blame that particular mental innovation on the Enlightenment. So to conclude, I would say to steer clear of Enlightenment thought when you're dealing with thinking about thinking, but often they say some very interesting things a bit further down the line. Thank you.